Well, we've it was quite a contrast between last week and this week, and Rick said, it is nice to see green grass and see the snow gone, but I don't imagine that will be the last of it, but it's nice to have it gone for the time being and be able to enjoy a little sunshine. When I was thinking of the sermon, the reason that I was drawn to the idea was a particular statement that was made in the book of Judges. And the statement is, there was no king in Israel. It's a statement made to ancient Israel during that time, and the question is, what does it mean, and how does it apply to you and me? There was no king in Israel. There's another phrase that goes with it, which we'll look at. But what we're going to do is we're going to look at the context of where that is said, and then we're going to see if there are any lessons that we can discern for us today. So Israel was led by the man of God, Joshua, and they had successfully conquered a significant portion of the promised land. And God, as promised, had been with Joshua and the people of Israel, but Joshua's life came to an end, and as his life was coming to an end, what was Israel's condition? Let's go to Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2. Israel had been imminently successful under Moses' leadership. They had been faithful leaders. Joshua had been a faithful leader, and they had not conquered the whole land, but they had conquered a large portion of it by the time that that Joshua's life was coming to a close. And it's interesting what it says here in Joshua chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. So God had entered into covenant with Israel. He had been with them. He had kept his promise. And he had helped them to be able to drive the Canaanites out of the land and help them to become established there. Verse 2. God told them, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this? So they had been told that when you take the land, when you conquer it, then you are to destroy all of the religious things of the land, to remove them, to destroy them, and not to have anything to do with them. But Israel had not done that. And the question is asked by God, why have you done this? Verse 3, therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall be thorns in your side, and their God shall be a snare to you. So you've not done what I ask you to do. So as a result of that, you're going to suffer the consequences. And their religion is going to come back to haunt you, and these people are going to be a thorn in your side. Verse 4, so it was when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel that the people lifted up their voices and wept. They heard what was said here and they wept because they realized that they were not living up to the covenant as they should. And the name Bochim there means weeping if you look at your margin. So everybody went back to their own inheritance, and life proceeded. Then we come down to verse 7. It says, so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had been seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. So during Joshua's lifetime, there had been great works done, and they had seen them. Obvious interventions of God. If you were involved in the battle against one of the cities where the sundial went backward, you knew, that's not normal, that something special has taken place here today. So God had done great things for Israel, and they had seen them. And the generation that of Joshua and those that came after him saw all these things. And they had seen the good works God had done for Israel. Then we come to verse 10. When all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, that's the generation that that Joshua had led. So when they had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. So they, so you come here and there's another generation coming up, and they didn't see what the previous generation saw. They hadn't seen the good works that God had done. They weren't aware of those things. They weren't significant to them. And as a result of that, they made certain decisions and had certain approaches, and there were certain outcomes that began to be happening over and over again in a cyclical manner. And that cycle is described beginning in verse 11. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals rather than God. And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them, and they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Asherahs. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of the plunderers who despoiled them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. So Israel was defeated by their enemies, and they were made subject to their enemies. In fact, there's one situation there where the people that took them over, I believe it was the Midianites, their goal was to destroy Israel, to annihilate them. So genocide isn't a new thing. Verse 15, wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. So they would sin, they would go into servitude, and then God would raise up judges to lead them to salvation, to lead them out of the trial they found themselves in. So they would go to God and they would cry out to him, and they would send judges. So this was a cycle that they went through over and over again. And the thing was, when they would go to God and they would plead with God to mercifully intervene, he would send the judge and give them relief. And they would follow the judge and they would stay on track. And then what would happen? When the judge died, they would very quickly go back to their old habits. And it was a cycle throughout Israel's history. I think if you look at the church, that has been a cycle as you look at the church over the years, and I think as you look at our lives, we kind of go through the same cycle. And it's a cycle we want to stay out of. We just want to be in the closeness to God and enjoy salvation. We don't want to go through the sin and the servitude and all of that. We don't want to go through that. So what we are going to, so that's what we see at the beginning of the book. And this was a cycle that goes all the way through the period of the judges. Now, what's interesting is, so now we're going to go to the end of the book, Judges chapter 17. And that will be our focus, Judges 17, chapter 17 and through 21. That will be our focus here. And this is where we see the phrase that I began the sermon with, there was no king in Israel. And as you look at these last chapters, you would think chapters 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21 would be in chronological order, but in fact, they're not. I've quoted from the beginning of the situation there where it talked about Joshua's death and all of that. Well, what we find here with chapters 17 through 21 is that these things are taking place at the end, or at the beginning of Israel's history in the land of Canaan. Now, why would I say that? There are several reasons why we would conclude that these chapters all take place at the beginning of Israel's history in the land of promise. For instance, one of the first reasons why that makes sense is as you look at chapter 18, verses 1 through 3, it tells us about the tribe of Dan had not fully received their inheritance. They hadn't received it all yet. They did receive an allotment, but it wasn't big enough for the tribe of Dan. So they needed more territory. And so we see the Danites going through the land, and they found this city that wasn't aligned with any other cities. They were just out there by themselves. And so they saw it as easy pickings for them. And so they eventually conquered the city of Laish and established that as a part of their territory. And that would make sense to have happened at the beginning of the conquest as opposed to the end of it. You know, so it's the beginning, it's either at the end of the conquest, at the end of Joshua's life, or probably at the beginning of the time of the judges. A second point that you might think about is found in chapter 18, verse 30, and it identifies a priest who officiated at the shrine in Dan, and it identifies him as Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh. Now that's interesting because if you look in your margin, like in my margin, it points out that the name there is not Manasseh, but it actually says Moses. And if you look at the Hebrew text, which I can't interpret and you can't either, probably, but if you look at various commentators, you'll find that there's the way the word Manasseh is written in Hebrew, there's a little letter there called a nun, okay? And what you find is that the way that it's put in there indicates that it's something that they added. It's something that they added. It was not part of the original text. And if you take that nun out of there, then it's not Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, but Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses. So we know that Moses had a son named Gershom. And so a lot of scholars look at this and they feel that they inserted this nun in there in order to put the name Manasseh in there in order not to ascribe to Moses that his grandson was one of the first to lead Israel astray in apostasy. Here he is, a relative of Moses, a righteous man, and this man was not righteous. So if this is correct, then the actions mentioned in connection with Micah and the Danite conquest of Laish must have occurred late in the period of Joshua or early in the period of the judges, because Jonathan would have been Moses' grandson. Moses had died, and Jonathan lives on, and he's living during this late in Joshua's life or early in the time of the judges. A third point here that points to this as something that's happening early is in Joshua chapter 20, verse 1 and verses 27 through 28. And it tells us that when Israel was roused to action against the tribe of Benjamin, they assembled before the Lord where Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, was still serving. So Phinehas was the son of the high priest who had killed the people who were involved in the sexual immorality in Numbers chapter 25. He's the one that took the spear and plunged it through the man and the woman, killing them both. And he was the grandson, or excuse me, he wasn't the son of Aaron, but the grandson, and hence of the same generation as Jonathan, so who seems to have been the grandson of Aaron's brother Moses. So Phinehas was old enough to have survived into the period of Joshua and perhaps the early part of the judges. So again, this would have to take place early on in the period. And then as you look at the war between, which we'll examine here in a little bit, there was a war between all the tribes of Israel and Benjamin. And the outcome of that war was that there were only 600 men of Benjamin left. So if you look at this chronologically, then you can say, well, this took place at the end of the time of the judges. Well, if that's the case, then basically for them to replenish the number of people and to be a full tribe, you only have 120 years from Saul to the time of Rehoboam. Because it shows in the example of Rehoboam that Rehoboam put together an army of 180,000 people. And that would come primarily from Judah and Benjamin. So there must have been a period of time, a long period of time for the, the tribe to be replenished. So it makes more sense that it would take place early in the time of the judges. Then you have 400 years for the tribe to grow back to its full size. So the point that I'm making here, as you look at these last chapters, this is taking place at the beginning of the period of the judges. And it's telling you, at the beginning of the period of judges, we already have problems in the nation of Israel. So they, and the thing is, you know, you say, well, these things are out of chronological sequence. Is it a mistake? It's not a mistake. Someone who wrote, whoever wrote the book of Judges, looked at these incidents, and they felt that these incidents fit with what was happening during that period. They were incidents that people needed to look at and learn certain things from, because they were indicative of where Israel was at. There's a certain logic to placing them at the end of the book. The structure highlights the theme of the disintegration of Israel. And the reason for this disintegration will be found as we examine the last few chapters here in more detail. So let's begin in chapter 17. Chapter 17. It says, "Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim." So this man is living in the territory of the tribe of Ephraim, whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you." So his mother had 1,100 shekels of silver, which to me, 1,100 shekels, that was probably a lot of money. And so she had 1,100 shekels that were taken from you and on which you put a curse. And the reason that she put a curse on the money was because they had been stolen from her. And even saying it in my ears, so Micah had heard her utter the curse upon whoever had stolen this money. And he says, "Here is the silver with me. I took it." So he had stolen from his mom the 1,100 shekels of silver. And so how does the mother take care of this? You know, we talked about correction last night when we did Growing Kids God's Way. So as you look at this, is this over-punishing or under-punishing? She said, he gives her back the money, and she says to him, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." I'm thinking under-punishing there. Okay, so if you weren't there last night, that's what we talked about with Growing Kids God's Way. So he did return it to his mom, probably thinking, okay, if this curse comes true, it's probably going to be bad for me, so maybe I should just give the money up. So he gives it back to her. "So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, 'I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son.'" So this woman had taken the 1,100 shekels of silver and dedicated it to God. All right? And that is the true God. You know, when it mentions the Lord there, it's talking about Yahweh, the eternal. And so she had dedicated it to the Lord for my son to make a carved image. Oops. So it's dedicated to the true God, but what we're going to do with it is we're going to make a carved image. That would mean you're going to get a piece of wood and you're going to shape it into whatever you want, and then you're going to cover it with silver. Okay? So So she's going to have a carved image and a molded image. So the molded image would be solid silver. So you're going to make an image of solid silver as well. And now, therefore, I will return it to you. So these things are supposedly dedicated to God. Now notice she dedicated the whole 1,100 shekels, but she's only going to kick in 200. Kind of like Ananias and Sapphira, you know, where they said, "Well, we're going to give you all this," but really they were holding back a portion of it. So so she gives them the money, and they go and they make these images. Verse 4, "Then he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made the carved image and the molded image, and they were in the house of Micah." So they make make these images, and then in verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine. He had a shrine in his home. Okay? And what was wrong with that? Well, you were to have a shrine in your home. Where was the place of worship? Where was the place where they were to worship? It was at Shiloh at this point. That's where the tabernacle was set up. So that place had been chosen as the place to set up the tabernacle, and that's where they were to worship. They were not to have private shrines. So, but that's what they had. So they had a shrine and made an ephod. Now, who wore an ephod? If you look through the scriptures, the one who wore the ephod was the high priest. So they made an ephod and household idols. And he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So here you have Israel. This is the beginning of the period of the judges, in all probability, as we looked at the points that helped to support that. So you see that here they're supposed to be worshiping at the tabernacle, and they're to be honoring the great God who dwells there, and instead they're setting up a shrine to God in their own house. So as you think about this, their intention isn't necessarily to defy God or to adopt pagan worship, but what you see here is that they are doing that very thing. They're doing that very thing. As you go on through here, let's go down to verses 12 and 13. Later on in the story, first of all, Micah chooses his son to be the priest, and then down from up in Bethlehem comes a man by the name of Jonathan, whom we've already mentioned, the son, grandson of Moses. And he's a Levite. And it says in verse 12, "So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, 'Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as priest.'" So is God going to bless you for doing this, for setting up a shrine in your home, making idols that you put in there as part of that shrine dedicated to God, and for setting up your own priest? Is God going to bless that? But their intentions were good. I mean, the money was dedicated to God. But do good intentions get the job done? They don't. So they set this shrine up. And so as you look at that, you see that there's a blending of God's way of life and those things that God instructed them not to do. And with the idolatry, it was the worship of God united to idolatry, which is the sin of syncretism, which is the mixing of the true religion with false. And this is something that God forbade. Always has, always will. Let's, you might keep your finger there, because we'll come back and go to Deuteronomy chapter 12. He specifically forbids this. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 29. Deuteronomy 12, verse 29. It says, "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to possess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them." And as we looked at Judges chapter 2, they had become ensnared. And he said, don't let them ensnare you. And they had become ensnared. He said, "After they are destroyed from before you, that you do not inquire after their gods." It doesn't matter who their gods are or anything about them. So don't inquire after their gods, saying, "How do these nations serve their gods? I will also do likewise." You know, let's say that we conquer the land of the Aztecs. All right? So are we going to worship the snake god, the winged serpent? Are we going to worship him and begin using their pyramids to make human sacrifice? And that would be the course we would follow if we were following the Israelite model. So God said, what you need to do is dismantle the pyramid. Get rid of it. And But that's not what they did. He says, you shall not worship, in verse 31, you shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abomination to the Lord which he hates they have done to their gods, for they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Now, at that time, they burned their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Well, the Aztecs just ripped their hearts out, one after another, to placate their gods. So what should we do? He says in verse 32, whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it, nor shall you take away. So God tells you, this is the way to worship me. Don't add to it. Don't take away from it. Just, here's, I've told you what to do, so just do it. Fairly simple, but it seems like it's very hard for us to do. So there is a blending of the true and the pagan. And that was the path that Israel followed here and throughout her history. That was the way they went. Now, let's go back to chapter 17 and look at verse 6. And this phrase, this sentence is in there, and it's in there for a reason. Because look at, we see what we looked at here with the false religion blended with the true, and what was going happening with the establishment of a priest and a shrine in the man's home. And then it says in verse 6, in those days there was no king in Israel. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now, it says, every man did that which was right in his own eyes, that portion of the phrase. It basically, every man was his own governor, and he did what he felt was right. And when a man's own will and desire are able to be made the rule of law, society is in trouble. When you, basically out of your own head, are the law, and you're not answerable to any higher authority, your society is in serious, serious trouble. And the condition of Israel at this point was that that's the way it was. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And it was a serious problem. You know, as you think about that, there's a proverb that goes with that mindset of every man doing what is right in his own eyes. You probably all are familiar with the Proverbs 14, verse 12, and Proverbs 16, verse 25. And what do they say? There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death. It'll kill you, and it'll kill your society, if that's the approach that you take. It's a recipe for disaster. Now, I don't think, you know, as you look at these people, I don't think their goal was to be to set up an apostasy. That wasn't their goal. There wasn't their goal to openly rebel against God. But that was the effect, that they were involved in apostasy and they were in rebellion against God. Even if you have a good attitude, if you do this, you're still rebelling against God. So sincerely attempting to please God is no excuse for breaking his direct commands. And we all have to remember this, you know, in our own worship. We cannot blend the world's religion with the true religion. They're incompatible. Now, it says that that every man did what was right in his own eyes, but why? Why did he do that? Why was that the way that people were living? Well, the beginning of verse 6 tells us why. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel. The reason they were doing what was right in their own eyes was because there was no king in Israel. Now, you might say simplistically, well, of course there was no king at that time. There were judges. Okay, that's true. But think about it. If there had been a physical king in Israel, do you think it would have changed people's mindset of doing what was right in their own eyes? Does a physical king make any difference? Maybe. Maybe a king has enough power to basically put down any activities like that. But, and as you look at the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, you had some good kings and you had some terrible kings. And as you had good kings, the people tended to do better, and as you had rotten kings, they tended to do just as rottenly as the king did. So just having a physical king isn't the answer here. It's pointing you to something else. It's telling you something else. The question is, this is during the period of the judges, and the question is, should there have been a king in Israel? Should there have been a king in Israel even during the time of the judges? Well, there should have been. Who should have been that king? You might keep your fingers there in chapter 17 and go to 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 12. 1 Samuel 12, verse 12. And this statement is in the context of Israel wanting a king. 1 Samuel 12, verse 12. And when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, one of those kings who dominated Israel as a result of their sin, and when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, "No, but a king shall reign over us." We want a physical king to reign over us. When the Lord your God was your king. Israel had a king from the time that they came out of the land of Egypt and they entered into a covenant with God. God was to be their king. God was to be their king. Moses was God's vice regent, in essence. He was God's representative on earth to lead Israel. Same thing with Joshua. And God was to be their king. He was the one to whom they were to look. And you see, as you look to the king, and you look to his law, and you look to his guidance in the way that you live, then it's impossible for you to do what is right in your own heart. But if you don't live under that king, then all options are open, aren't they? So everybody was doing what was right in their own heart because they weren't worshiping the king. They weren't submissive to the king. And this is taking place at the beginning of the period of the judges, not at the end. You can see where they were already on the wrong track. So what happens when there was no king in Israel and when everybody's doing what they want? Well, you see them begin to disintegrate religiously. They're beginning to go down the tubes religiously, which is a serious problem. So what happens here in chapter 18 is that Micah sets up this shrine, and they've got the whole worship thing going. And the Danites, they're looking to expand their territory, and they're looking for a place to conquer. And they come upon Micah. And they notice, hey, this guy's got his own setup here. And they see he's got his priest, he's got his idols, he's got the whole shebang. And they're impressed. And so they asked this priest, "Well, how's it going to go for us? We're looking to find territory to conquer, and we found this city out there, and it looks pretty vulnerable, but what do you think? How is God going to be with us in this?" And so Jonathan, the Levite, says, "God's going to be with you. Go and conquer. It's all going to go really well." And they went and they conquered, and it did go really well. So then they came back and said, "You know what? We like your setup, and we really like your priest." And they took him, and he left with them, and they took his gods, and they took the priest, and they left. And what was the outcome of that? Let's go to Judges chapter 18 and look at the end of the chapter there in verses 30 and 31. "Then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh," or the son of Moses, as my margin says, "and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land." So from the early time of the judges, Dan was already caught up in apostasy. All the way through the period of the judges, all the way down to 720, 721, when the Assyrians took them away captive. So you've got a very 700-year period, basically, that they are in apostasy. And they were the first ones as a tribe to leave God and to go in a false way. It says in verse 31, so they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made, and all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. They didn't go up to the house of God in Shiloh. That's where they should have been focused. That's where the tabernacle was, but they didn't do that. We've got our own set up here. We don't need to go down there. We've got our own religious way of doing things. And this is the reason that you don't find Dan mentioned in the book of Revelation, when you have all those tribes mentioned there that are faithful to God. So we see this false religion, and we see that it expands from one man's household to a whole tribe. Now let's go to chapter 19. Chapter 19 in verse 1. And chapter 19, verse 1, begins in the same way that as chapter 18, which also began with, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. And chapter 19 begins the same way. It says, and it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim, and he took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. So there was no king in Israel, and everybody did that which was right in his own eyes. And we move on to something, an atrocity here. And we find a disastrous war which comes about as a result of a single incident. Just to recount that for you, this Levite had married, had taken this concubine, and from Bethlehem, Judah, and the concubine left him and went back to her father's house in Bethlehem. So he went after her down to Bethlehem, and he goes down and he seeks to bring her back, and so she agrees she's coming back with him back to the remote hills of Ephraim. So he goes and he stays at her father's house, and he stays there for a prolonged period of time, longer than he wants, and finally said, look, I got to go. And he left later than he wanted to. And so as they're making their way northward, they come to Jebus, which eventually became Jerusalem. And his servant says, well, maybe we can stay here for the night. And he said, well, I'm not staying with these heathen pagans here in Jebus. We'll go on to Gibeah or one of the other cities of Israel. And they end up going to Gibeah. So they come into the town of Gibeah, and they go to the town square. Now, if you were a traveler in that particular time, that's where you would go. And the custom was that if you came to the town square, and everybody in that town knew each other, and they knew you had to be a stranger, you're a traveler, and what was expected was that someone would take them in and show them hospitality. So nobody did. That's a problem. Nobody showed them hospitality, offered them that. So then here comes this old man, and he notices them there in the town square, and he talks to them and says, he asks them where they're from, and he said, from the remote hills of Ephraim. And he said, well, I'm from Ephraim as well. So they have a common bond, and they said, well, we're just going to sleep here in the square. And the old man says, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that, so I'll take you into my home. So he does. He takes them into his home. And the result is that he's there and he's taking care of his guest when here comes some perverts from the city of Gibeah. They knock on the door and said, hey, send out that guy that just came here. We want to get to know him carnally. So the man says, no, I'm not sending him out. That would be unacceptable to do that to a guest. And he says, but I'll send my daughter out. And the Levite says, well, I'll send my concubine out. And they eventually do send the concubine out, and she is gang raped. An atrocity takes place. And she dies in the process. So he loads her up the next morning, and he takes her back to his home, and then he cuts her up, and he sends her to the other tribes, apart to each tribe, as a message, telling them of the atrocity that's taken place there. And as a result of this, war ensued, a war between the tribes of Israel and the one tribe of Benjamin. Now, the people were outraged at what had taken place there. They were outraged at what had taken place there. Now, why were they outraged? Why would a war take place over this one single incident? There are two reasons for this. One is cultural, and the other is historical. The cultural reason is that life in the Middle East was tough, and people were nomadic, and life was difficult. And so an elaborate system of social customs was developed. And one of the social customs that was developed was that you were to entertain a stranger, somebody that was a traveler. You were to take them in. And you were to take them in as a guest, even if they were from an enemy tribe, if there was a time of peace. So there were certain expectations that you would be respectful to somebody who's traveling through your land, and you would welcome them into your home. And if due benevolence was not shown, it was deemed an act of hostility and impiety before God. And if the offense was serious enough, then war could break out. It was a great offense, and it was seen by the tribes of Israel as a great offense. But interestingly, as I said, there's a second factor that's historical. And that relates to the persistent memory of Sodom and Gomorrah. And they knew this from the Bible, and they lived in the land where that had taken place. The abominable behavior of the inhabitants of the city of Gibeah was very similar to what took place in Sodom and Gomorrah. As you think about it, by comparing the behavior of the Gibeite, sons of Belial, the perverts, as it calls them in the New King James Version, and the old man, and the conduct of the men of Sodom and Lot, there's a great similarity there. And these people remembered that the destruction against Sodom and their neighbors that took place, and the destruction was so complete that you didn't find any evidence of them. And they were fearful of that. They knew what had taken place here, and it was similar to what took place with Sodom and Gomorrah, and God is going to wreak vengeance on us for this unless we deal with it. So as we factor the understanding of these elements into the story, we can see why war would break out. The Levite was a representative of God, to whom the Gibeites were extremely inhospitable and showed open and flagrant impiety. And, you see what they did there. It is something that was a very grave sin in Israel. So, and you also notice here, if you look at it, that the Levite didn't treat the concubine very well. Nor did the man he stayed with treat his own daughter very well. Even to consider sending your daughter out, I can't imagine that. So it's an appalling story all around. It's a horrible story, and it's one that's recounted later on in the prophets. Let's go to Hosea chapter 9, verse 9. It's recounted twice in the book of Hosea. Hosea 9, verse 9. The first of the minor prophets, Hosea 9, verse 9. It says, "They are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeah." So Gibeah is where this atrocity took place. "He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins." And Gibeah is mentioned again in chapter 10, verse 9. So this atrocity takes place, and the tribes of Israel gather together for war. And they put together 400,000 soldiers. that are arrayed against Benjamin. And they come up to the city of Gibeah and say, look, turn over the people that were involved in this sin. That would have ended it right there. But the people of Benjamin said, no way, we're not turning those guys over. In fact, we're all going to join together and fight you guys. We're not going to give in. We're not going to send them out. We're going to protect them. And it's indicative of, you know, the problems that existed in Israel at that time. So you have 400,000 against about 30,000 Benjamites. So Israel is arrayed against them, and they go and they find out whether God's going to support this, and God is. So they're there on the battlefield, and God's with us, and they're defeated. They're defeated. And a large number of them, 22,000 of them, are killed. And it doesn't mention any Benjamites that are killed. So they're like, oh man, what happened? And they go out again, and 18,000 more of them are killed. So you've got 40,000 dead. That's 10% loss already. And they didn't understand why that was. And it doesn't explain why God did not give Israel, the 400,000 men of Israel, favor against Benjamin right off the bat. Obviously, he wasn't happy with them. And so the result is that they go to where Phinehas is, the high priest, and they humble themselves before God in fasting and prayer. What's wrong? Why are you doing this to us? And they sacrifice to God, and fasting and sacrificing to God was something rare in this period. And God may have wanted them to come to the point where they saw the need for this. So they went back. They went to Phinehas, and Phinehas said, go up, and they went, and they defeated Benjamin this time. And they routed the Benjamites. And as a result of the slaughter, there were 600 Benjamites left. And the 600 Benjamites fled to a stronghold, and they hold up there for 4 months. And the men of Israel were so upset by their losses and what had taken place here that even greater atrocities took place. In the 4 months that the 600 Benjamites were in the stronghold, they went out and they killed every man, every woman, and every child that was still left in the cities of Benjamin. They may have felt that was deserved because all of these cities had contributed men to the Benjamites to fight them, but they killed them all. And so when it was done, there were 600 Benjamites left, men. And then the light bulb went off over their head, and they're like, oops. We killed everybody, so how is the tribe of Benjamin going to continue on? And they all realized, well, wait a minute, we made a vow that we're not going to give any of our children to the Benjamites, so we can't do that. And so then somebody had the bright idea, hey, look, Jabesh-Gilead. Gilead is on the eastern side of the Jordan. They didn't send anybody up. Hey, we can go down and wipe them out, and we'll save the virgins. Good idea. So they went down, killed everybody there. 400 of those 400 young ladies left for the 600 Benjamites. Well, that's still 200 short. So none of them could give their daughters to the Benjamites. They made that vow, so what are they going to do? So then they said, we can't give them away, but they can take them. And so they said, okay, there's going to be a festival here, and a lot of young ladies are out here dancing around at this festival, and so you guys can swoop in there and take the girls. And we will stop all the dads and brothers and everybody from going after them and stopping this. So that was the solution they came up with. So as you can see, it's called twisted logic. Okay? It's twisted logic is what you find here. And you can see that, and as you look at that, you can see there was no king in Israel. And they did what was right in their own eyes over and over again. So you can see why there were difficulties in Israel. As you think about these vows that they had entered into, what should they have done? Well, following through on the intent of their oaths would have put them in, you know, a position that was very difficult, and that was the problem. It was their own vantage point, their own doing what was right in their own eyes. And what should they have done? They should have repented of making foolish vows. And secondly, they should have gone to Phinehas and inquired of God about what to do. Now, if they were truly seeking God, he would have given them an answer. And God's direct commands always override any vow. So if you vow something that violates God's law, that vow is invalid because you cannot vow something that is going to invalidate God's law. Now, as you look in the scriptures, you find that a father could void a vow and a husband could void a vow. So if that could be done, couldn't Israel's husband, couldn't Israel's father void their vow? He could have. So the real solution here was humble repentance, humbly walking before God, something that was sorely lacking in the period of the judges when everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So the book of Judges ends in chapter 21, verse 25, in the following way. It says, in those days there was no king in Israel. There was no physical king, but that's not the point. The point was the spiritual king was not king. And as a result of that, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So there are three things that we can look at here as we conclude, points, things we can draw from what we've seen here. God has established three institutions in society. One of them is the home. The second one is he has established government. And the third one is a system of worship. Now, as we started out here in chapter 17, does anybody recognize that there was a little bit of confusion in Micah's home? Anybody recognize that? There might have been a bit of confusion there. You know, as you look at, we know that the family is the foundation of society. That's what God established in the book of Genesis. And he established Adam and Eve, brought them together in marriage, and that was the foundation of the world. And it is foundational to our society today. And we're not going to go there, but if you look in Psalm 11, verse 3, it says, when the foundations are destroyed, it can't stand. It's not going to hold up. So if you destroy the family, which is foundational, which is well on its way, the society can't hold together. It can't hold together. And you see the disintegration that was going on in Israel as a result. What we see with Micah, his mother, and their household is a family that is spiritually and morally confused. As you look at them, they manage to break all 10 commandments, and yet not feel guilty at all about doing so. The son didn't honor his mother. Instead, he had stolen from her and then lied about it and then only turned the money back over when he realized I may be cursed. And then he lied about the whole enterprise, as I said, as the curse was uttered. So as you think about him, he broke the fifth commandment, which is to honor the parents. He broke the eighth, he broke the ninth, and he broke the tenth. He coveted that money, didn't he? And he broke the first and second commandments by having a shrine of false gods in his home. So he broke seven of the 10 commandments without blinking an eye, hardly. The man's, they were breaking the commandments with impunity. And Micah did not only had a private shrine, but he ordained his son to serve as priest. And he didn't honor God when God said, look, focus on the tabernacle where I dwell. And because Micah and his family didn't submit to the authority of God's word, in other words, they didn't accept that there was a king in Israel, their home was a place of religious and moral confusion. Secondly, as you look at the government at that time, the leadership of Israel was found in the high priest and the priesthood. And So God established the home to instruct parents how to raise their children, but he also established a spiritual leadership in the community. And the high priest and the priest were to do that. The center of the community was to be the tabernacle. And God has continued to do that in the church. God has set up a way for the people of God to be overseen by the ministry. As you look at this, the Levite named Jonathan had been living in Bethlehem. Now, why would a Levite be living in Bethlehem when that's not a city of the Levites? God assigned cities where the Levites were to live. Was he there just trying to survive? You know, it might be that he was there because the people of Israel at that time weren't supporting God's work with their tithes and offerings. So why would you live in a city where you're going to starve? They're not giving us any money. How are we going to make it? So when God's people, and this was a bad situation, so what he did is, instead of staying there and seeking God and his will, what he did is he set out to find a place to live and work, even if it meant abandoning his calling. So what was he doing? He was doing what was right in his own eyes. And the nation was at a low ebb spiritually and doing what was pleasing, was not doing what was pleasing to God. And he could have done the right thing and really been a positive force, but he didn't do that. So instead, he went to found Micah and said, "Oh, you're needing a priest? Well, I'll be happy to do whatever you want me to do." If Jonathan is typical of God's servants in that period of history, then it's no wonder that the nation had the problems that it had. He had no appreciation of his high calling as a Levite, a chosen servant of God. He didn't appreciate it. And Jonathan gave up his calling and his purpose in order to have comfort and security in the home of an idolater. Jonathan's ministry, however, wasn't spiritual at all. Think about it. He showed himself to be a hireling, not a true shepherd. And he showed that because he wasn't a spokesman for the Lord. He gave people the message they wanted to hear. And when he was offered a place involving more money, more people, and more prestige, he took it. "Hey, why serve one guy? I can serve a whole tribe." And he went right along with them. And then interestingly, he assisted the Danites in stealing his employer's gods. So, and Micah had set up this system of worship there in his house, and he ends up with nothing. It's all gone. Basically, they told him, "Look, we're taking the stuff, and if you get in the way, we're going to kill you." So he's intimidated, and I would be too, so he basically let them go. But you again see, all through this, everybody did what was right in their own eyes over and over again. Now, the third thing is confusion in society. God, as I said, God should have been king in Israel and his word the law that governed it. But the people preferred to do their own thing. And if the people had forsaken their idols and if the elders of Israel had consulted God's law and obeyed it, Israel could have been governed successfully. But when everybody does what's right in their own eyes, then society is in real trouble. And as you look at our society today, isn't that the case? We live in a society where there is no king. There is no king. They don't accept the king, and everybody does what is right in his own eyes. And you can see, you think about what's going on in our society. Do you see atrocious behavior? And why is that? Everybody is doing what is right in their own eyes. So we see these things unfolding here. And we see one of the things that's interesting that's coming, when the new health care reform bill is passed, one of the penalties that's going to be on all of us who are married is a marriage penalty. You're going to pay more taxes, a lot more taxes than if you're single. So what do people do when that happens? I'm not going to get married. And if I am married, I'm getting a divorce because then we get a tax break. Isn't that right? But that's what's going to happen. So is that going to help society? I don't think so. It's going to undermine it. We're doing things, maybe the intention isn't to undermine society, but you do some, you make certain decisions, and there are always consequences to it. So, brethren, we know the King, don't we? And we know that for us to do what is right in our own eyes is a path that leads to disaster. And the society around us may not acknowledge that King or follow that King. They may continue doing what is right in their own eyes. But for us, we must acknowledge the King. We must do what is right in His eyes. We must do what is right in His eyes. The question that we all have to answer is this: will we submit to that King or do what is right in our own eyes? Is there a King in Israel? Should be. We are the Israel of God. And the coming years are going to tell the tale of whether there is truly a King in Israel. So we'll look forward to seeing you out there tonight if you're able to make it.